Welcome to Label Deep Dives. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today's a big day because we're going to dive into Voyeurist deeply. This episode is built around the album's opening track, Damn Excuses, and we're also going to cover the bold choice and the implications of Under Oath choosing to not use an outside producer, but to believe in themselves and use the skills and wisdom that they've gained over the last couple of decades of having hands-on experience with some of the best producers in the world. This endeavor was a big bet on themselves with very high stakes, and it's a very big vote of confidence in their collective ability to trust each other and to navigate the new territory. The stakes were particularly high for the production leaders, that's the guitarist Tim McTague and the band's sound engineer JJ. So in this first episode, we also get an overview of their methods and their underlying philosophy of what producing really means. We also take a tour through the band's production history from their Only Chasing Safety through Define the Great Line all the way through Erase Me and the reflections and experiences of all of them that led them to Voyeurist. So I hope you dig this conversation as much as I do. And next time, we'll hear from a different set of band members and get some deep insight into track two, Hallelujah, and some other historical context of Under Oath. And if you didn't see episode zero, I would highly recommend that you go back and check that out. It sets the whole context of the band's reunion through Erase Me leading up to this album. There's a full video of that. You can find it either in this podcast feed on Spotify, or that video is at YouTube. If you go to the Labeled Universe YouTube page, you can find it there. But even if you skip that and you're new here, this conversation ought to make sense that way also. So glad you're here. Here's Tim and JJ and me. Last time on the making of Under Oath's Voyeurist.
You know, with us making Voyeurist, it's like, what if everyone is wrong?
All these other people trust us to make their music. Why can we not make our own record?
It's so scary.
Let's try something because we don't try anything.
I didn't do everything to my complete ability because I didn't feel like I had the ground to stand on.
Is Aaron even on this record?
Where's all this shit coming from? You know, like, oh, because we never fucking talk about this stuff.
I got you.
Oh, fantastic.
What's up, boys?
What up?
How are we?
Good to see you. I'm trying to decide what Zoom view I should record, like if it'll record, if I'm on speaker view or grid, the, you know, gallery view.
I'm good on my end. I've got Logic rolling, so I'll probably have to just send you my audio separately, Matt, if that's okay.
Okay. So do you guys get that question? Like, you know, fundamentally, this whole series is... you've gotten that question a lot, like, what's your songwriting process in interviews and Q&As?
Yeah, I mean, when someone asks about, like, how we write a song, they always reference a song, and or they just reference, like, 35 or 50 songs, and it's either, how does Under Oath in 20 years write a song, or I love this song, how did you write that song?
Yeah, but you get it sometimes in a Q&A at a thing, like in a quick question, like somebody asks a question, it's a 45-second window to answer, and it's like, what's your creative process? And it's like, well, yeah, the whole, my whole life, I mean, it's, that's the longest answer that there could possibly be, and in a short, you know, yeah.
It's almost impossible to answer without, like, somebody knowing you as a person, too, like, for it to make any kind of sense, like, and there's no formula, like, there is no right or wrong, there is no, it's like, everybody does things a different way and their own thing, and they react to that way. Like, it's literally personality tendencies. And that happened, like, people have musical tendencies that get informed by those personal tendencies, like, you know, just how you are as a person. Like, so it's almost the impossible question to answer. Like, what is the writing process? It's like, I don't know, existing probably, and just like paying attention. Like, is that it? I think that might be just it.
There's moments in Voyeurist where someone feels like they had a eureka moment, and it was literally what was being seeded into the psyche of the song and the DNA and the organism, as you call it, like yesterday by five other people. But if you're the one that figures out what you think it might could be right now, all of a sudden, based on the way that psychology works and biases work, it's like, I think I solved that problem. And it's like, what's your answer? And your answer back is like literally what we were just talking about yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a few of those on this record. And for me, I care more about the record and more about the whole than I do reminding people that that's not a unique idea. And I think that's what makes like creative special, is like, it's not about winning and being the guy that gets the W. It's about being part of a team that actually wins. And if we can move everyone in Under Oath, or anyone that JJ and I produce sidebar, which we do a good bit of, like our goal is not to make sure that everyone remembers that we changed their song to be better. It's just to make the song better. And when it wins and someone loves it and they go, who did that? Here we go. You know, and I think that origin story of like letting go, and it's like, oh, that's a great idea. Instead of being like, I literally said that a different way yesterday, dog. You know?
Yeah. Dude, I remember one moment during Voyeurist specifically when we were trying to figure out the chorus for Cycle. And that was one that Cycle, the fourth song. It was then called Dark. That was the song title then. And we just couldn't figure out the progression for the chorus. And it was like, we sat on this for literal like days and days. And we kind of just like put it off because we were just like, we can't figure it out. We're just going to move on to something else, get some other songs going. Maybe we'll find the inspiration somewhere else. Maybe something will inform it. And I remember specifically, there was one night I went home after a session and I voice memoed a potential, like an idea that I had for that chorus of just the progression. And I brought it to Chris the very next morning. And he was like, ooh, I like that. Me and him kind of rapped about it for a second. And then we showed you, Tim, and you were so hung up on the third chord. And you literally looked at me and Chris, you were like, that is dog shit, that chord. He was like, it is way too happy. It is trash. And I was like, okay, damn, I'm sorry, dude. Let's figure it out. And then Tim literally just like solved the magical puzzle with the last two chords. And it was like, oh my God, it was two chords that me and Chris never would have thought of. Like I wasn't even considering them. And it was immediate. And it was like that song got finished that day. And it was like, boom. I don't even know. Talk about the process. It was like, we learned to just like put it on the shelf for a second, but don't forget about it. Like let it, something's going to happen to inspire something to fix that later. We could finish it. Like, Nothing's lost. Like nothing's wrong. We have a good problem.
Hear trust as a big ingredient to be able to trust enough people to bring them ideas and then let them say it's dog shit. And the other theme that comes up a lot is you bring wrong ideas and then the right ideas appear.
Correct.
I honestly don't even think there's wrong ideas. I think there's ideas that are maybe step seven in a 12-step staircase to get to where you want to go. If you want to go to the next level, you know, every apartment complex has 8, 10, 12, whatever stairs. It's like, it doesn't matter if the thing that you built to get to the next step, to get to the actual level that you want to be creatively, is somewhere on the staircase and just gets stepped on, never thought about, never looked at. And that's why it's really hard to talk about the creative process, because something that literally our friends will say, or Elizabeth, my wife, will say, will change my entire view on a song. And she possibly, if we really get down to it, has produced a lot. And like
your kids are probably the same too.
Like JJ and, you know, my buddy Kurt, like our homie Kurt came in while we were demoing, while we were building the record, and he'd grab a few beers, he'd get a little loose, and then he wouldn't know his place and just be like, yeah, that sounds too harsh, or that's not cool enough. And we would turn around and be like,
say it out. Like, shut up, Kurt. We didn't ask you here to tell us what to do. And then we're like, damn it. He's right.
And then JJ will literally hit me at midnight and be like, fuck, Kurt's right. Like, how do we fix this? We have to go. So it's like, you look at credits, you look at the guys, like the key guys, and everyone thinks that like they're the guy. And in reality, music should be more of a community than it is cutting people out. And there's even times where, you know, Grant, James, Randy, anyone will give their input. And it's like, we have the ability to say, no, we hear you, but we don't care. You're off base. But if you listen, and when they're right and it changes a song from pretty good, might make the record, to let's make this one of the singles, everything changes there. And I think there's a lot of people that we can never credit because we can't quantify, that have helped Under Oath be what they are. I think it's very easy to talk about what you're creating things for, and everyone's like, oh, we do what we want. But in reality, like, there is an entire ecosystem socially that informs what I want to create. You know, in a weird way, I want Dustin and Tepe from Thrice to listen to our record and be blown away. I want someone from Slipknot that I don't even know and don't have their number to hear it and be like, holy shit, right? So it's like, we all pull from the people that we like, the bands we look up to, the people we respect, our friends, our family, our parents, our wives, our husbands, all of it. And it's like, everyone plays a social part in producing a record. You know, even JJ, it's like, he has these dudes that he's been rolling with, because JJ is like a real musician, not like Under Oath. Like, we around, like, he is world-class, like as good, if not better than Aaron at drums, plays bass better than all of us. He's just this savant, and he grew up in the like hipster, cool guy musician circle. And it's like, we're trying to impress everybody that we actually respect. I want Matt Carter to be blown away. I want Brandon Ebel to be blown away. I want these people to be blown away. So it's like, to say that a creative process is we hole up, we don't care, we do what we want, is true. But what we want is socially informed by everything we've experienced up until today. And we want to make sure that we honor everything that we respect up until now, and then push a boundary later. And I think that's really hard for a lot of people to admit. It's like, oh, I created that. Like, I went to a restaurant and had this idea. And it's like, if that's what creativity is, like, it's so simple and it's so dumb. In reality, it's way more complex. It's there's a depth of, I needed to go through this and lose this and win this and make this and lose this to get to a point where I can see what this song means to me right now.
Do you guys remember in your personal history the first recording that you ever were impacted by in a way that you were able to analyze from the outside and recognize what it was?
I think the moment that my brain started going like the deeper place and my ears started going there also was the Now Now record, Threads, 2013 or 2012 or something like that. I've probably listened to that record 5,000 times. And I love the production about it. And it literally was like a pivotal moment for me of like perspective on making something sound good and it not be like commercially the same shit you hear on like a Jason Aldean song or a, 2012, what was like Bon Iver was huge. And just like that production, those production styles. And like nothing, I realized that nothing had to be a certain way. It just needed to be cool. Like, I figured out what the word cool finally meant and not, and wasn't just like technically right. Cause like, I was such a sound guy. I was like, oh, make sure the gain's not too loud. And like, make sure the 60 hertz sounds really good. It's like, fuck that, dude. Is it cool? Like, literally, what if the kick drum had no 60 hertz in it at all? Get rid of all of it. and build the whole ethos around just that element. And that was like huge for my brain of like, wait, music might actually be the sickest shit. And I don't even care about the musician circle anymore. Like, it's not about performance here for me. It's about making this. It's about painting the bigger fucking thing. Like, because that record changed me so much. I was like, I want to do that. Like, I don't do that by just recycling the same chords I keep playing just because I know those chords and I play them really well. Like, I need to change the way that I'm thinking. Like, stop just going for those things that I would just go for because it's right. Like, that's dog shit. That's dog shit.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, for me, it was At the Drive-In, Relationship, and then Glassjaw, Worship and Tribute. And both done by Ross Robinson. And I've met him a few times, and he was just super cool. But I don't think he understands what he did. Like, most of Under Oath, insofar that my commitment to what we do, weighted differently by everyone, is mainly because of what Ross did. And it was the idea of, I don't want to capture things commercially and clean. I want to capture what we're capturing. Like, this band goes on tour and 50,000 people, you know, 50 tour dates at 1,000 people a night, sold out, let's assume, like a Glassjaw or an At the Drive-In. Like, this band has a following and people show up for what I'm seeing here. How do I take what this experience is and put it on a plastic piece of shit CD this big? And Ross Robinson, I think, started that. And obviously there's Rick Rubin and there's other people that are on the upper echelon, but like, for our scene, what Ross did was allow an At the Drive-In and a Glassjaw to exist in their element. And then he figured out when to elevate and when to push, because the band wasn't doing good enough, versus trying to change a band to get more plays and get more spots and get more radio. And literally, Glassjaw and At the Drive-In's records that they did with Ross, to me, are still top five best heavy records ever.
All the stories I know is like, he'll throw things at the, make people stand up and jump around while they track and throw stuff at them or tackle them in the middle of a take and stuff to, you know, to make the energy be there. Yeah.
Like, Ross seems to be so meta, and I don't think that's where we go. But what I pull from him is like, records can sound cool and also not sound quote unquote good. And when something could be bigger and louder, but it's worse, like, Ross Robinson is that guy. He's the guy that said, if it got bigger, if it got louder, even if it got bigger in sales, it's just worse. And I care about what this band's trying to say. And I think that's really important.
Oh, immensely important.
Yeah, because there's no right answers to his records, obviously. Like, they, some of them you would easily say sound bad, and that's the, how they should sound.
What I love about it is, if I go to Full Sail and get a degree on hertz and frequencies, his records sound bad.
A degree but in when hertz.
You, when you listen to Worship and Tribute, that snare drum with that ping that you can't unhear should never be anything but that.
Dude, remember Butcher Tim with the shittiest snare on the planet, and he was like insisting
that, yeah, kind of shit. Yeah, totally.
So bad, like the worst sounding snare I ever heard. And he was like, "It's that is has to be it." I'm like, "All right," and it ended up being magic. It's crazy.
And I think Interpol's big record informed everything after. And it was overhyped, and the drums were distorting and compressed and huge, and the bass. And it was this weird, like, everything's loud, but nothing's harsh, but everything's also dysfunctional and it's perfect. And then you come out with like another record, and it's like, that's not what your band's supposed to sound like. You know, like, there's very few people that can capture a band in the studio and go, it's wrong now. Moving forward forever. And it's wrong now live, and it's wrong now with the next producer and the next engineer. Like, this is what your band is supposed to sound like. And I think even Glassjaw has done a really good job of maintaining that, you know, whether it be budget or ethos, I don't know. And I can't speak to it, but it's like everything Beck and Daryl do is kind of gross and it's loud, but it's also muddy. And there's a vibe to it that most bands are terrified to fuck with because they need a validation from someone else. And it's like, when I hear our record, I think about it against every other record. And I'm like, Voyeurist is this, to me, powerful creative idea audibly when it's all finished and done. And it was intentional every step of the way through, but someone's going to go, why didn't you sample the snare? Why did you do this? Right. And it's like, bro, if you want a basic record, go listen to a basic fucking band and go find a basic label to like consume music.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just different stuff. Different strokes.
It's not about if you overproduce or oversample or over edit. It's bad. It's merely our band can't exist in that. And we do, which we've done already once before in 2018 with Erase Me. You know what you get. You get a less good version of a band that you wish would have done more. And in fact, we worked twice as hard on that album to clean ourselves up. And that's not what we're trying to do anymore. We've never done it. We tried it. We realized that like that's a bad move.
And is that, let's look at the whole historical progression to get to where we are, including Erase Me. But if you just, in the context of what we're talking about already, what comes to your mind as far back as you can remember and under oath of what was good and bad practices in the studio?
Going back to Chasing Safety, we went to Matt Goldman's studio in Little Five in Atlanta and demoed, I believe, Dangerous Business, Reinventing Your Exit, and a few other songs. We only had three or four, and we were floating around. We didn't have a manager at the time. And we were going to make the record, and we ended up going with James Wisner again, which was a safe play. I mean, he did the record before, and it was just in Florida. It all happened. Things were just kind of in motion. And listening back to what Chasing Safety is now, like if you own the vinyl, if you own the record, or if you just go on Spotify or Apple Music, like that version of that record was a secondary version from when we demoed. And we listened back to Matt Goldman's demos. It's like, why do these feel like us? And why does this record feel polished? And so when we started to look at the next album, Define the Great Line, we went with Matt Goldman, and it was like, we don't want to demo with this guy. We want someone who's willing to just capture something and make the snare, quote unquote, too big or too small. But at least what we hear out of the speakers is us. And we ended up pulling in Adam D, and, you know, Matt and Adam were our guys for a bit. And Adam was such a perfectionist and so good at guitars. And Matt was so good at drums that I felt like we constantly like married these two experts in their fields, and it wouldn't have been the same if we went with one or the other. We needed them both based on what they did. And I think for me, long-term, it's like, figure out someone who understands what you want to do and figure out someone who's willing to get you to where you want to be and doesn't have an agenda. And I think we saw that with every record. And then the problem is when you go to get it mixed, all those nuances that you actually care about just get flatlined. The snare sounds the same. Everything's replaced. Everything's processed. Everything's the same loudness. And it makes a good product, but it's less good than when we left the studio. And I think that's where Voyeurist came in. It's like, we can't just make the record here. We have to figure out who's going to mix it, who's going to master it. Like, we want the weird, uncomfortable, muddy moments to actually translate when it's all said and done. Because I can send my five best friends and a few family members like a demo and be like, how cool was the song before we screwed it up? It's like, let's stop screwing it up. And in reality, like the mastering guy inherits the sins of the mixing guy, who inherits the sins of the producer guy. And if you can control all that, then what you get when it comes out a year later, 4 months later, whatever it is what you set out to do.
But with They're Only Chasing Safety, and I've heard you discuss it many times, and I've heard you hold multiple opinions about it, but do you have regret about the way it turned out being too polished? Do you think it would have been better, or would have affected your trajectory in a way that you would have done it differently?
I mean, being older and being where I sit now, and I can actually look back at everything we've done with perspective, where when you're in it and you don't have a break and you never break up and it's just your job, you really don't have any introspective capacity to look back at what you've accomplished and or missed. And I think we all have that now. And for me, I'm fully proud of every record we've ever done.
But there were times when I've heard you spend time trying to disown They're Only Chasing Safety. I mean, that phase occurred, I feel like.
It did. I mean, with Chasing Safety, that was a really tough moment in time because we lost Alice. We had a new singer. We were trying to figure out where we were, but we couldn't stop. Like, you couldn't take 8 months off and figure out, what do we want to be? Where do we want to go? Like, what songs do we want to create? And then we wrote this record in a very similar way as Voyeurist. Like, we just went. Like, a couple weeks, write some songs. Do you like it? Do you like it? Does it make you feel? Yep. Move on. Let's go in the studio. And then it exploded. And it wasn't about being not proud of that record or those songs. It was about when you explode from 0 to 60 like that, now everyone expects you to do that forever. And that's what was crippling for us. It's like, this was just a portion of our journey. And now you almost feel like a child actor who ages out as soon as you start getting like facial hair, right? And it's not bad, but this isn't the end. And everyone's like, oh, this is the end. Like, it's the biggest thing. This is what Under Oath is. Under Oath is this kind of band. And in reality, it's like, no, we're just getting started. And so I think long-term, what Chasing Safety and Define and Lost in the Sound and Disambiguation did for us was allow us to kind of flesh out all of the stages of where we need to be and then put back the pieces together when we're ready to, which is hilarious to me.
Okay, pardon the interruption here, but we got to thank the sponsor, the title sponsor that believed in the show before they even heard it and before it was even done, and that's Rockabilia. They're an awesome company. They've been doing band merch and memorabilia and stuff like that for a very long time. They're an independently owned and operated outfit from Minnesota. They're located in Minneapolis. They're, you know, a true kind of company that cares and does awesome stuff. Worked with them in the past. They've got over 500,000 officially licensed merch items, which is cool because officially licensed means that the bands get paid. It's not bootleg or anything like that. And they've just got everything out there. No matter what type of music you like, they've got something from your favorite band, I promise you. But especially since your favorite band might be in the neighborhood of Under Oath, I know for a fact they have classic Under Oath designs in stock right now because I just checked them out. And there's some old ones there that I remember seeing back in the day, and they are awesome. Not only that,
we have a quite easy promo code for you to remember how to get 15% off. That code is Under Oath. So go look at the Under Oath merch for 15% off on rockabilia.com, and you will get a 15% discount on your entire order, because while you're there, there's tons of other bands you like, tons of gifts. I don't know, maybe Valentine's gifts coming up, something like that. You're supporting a great company, again, independently owned and operated, been a part of the scene for a long time. Thank you for sponsoring the show. Thank y'all for listening. Glad I could make the introduction. Rockabilia.com. Use the code UNDEROATH for a 15% discount on your entire order. Okay.
Well, let's move through to Erase Me then, and let's talk a little bit more of the story. We didn't, in episode zero, quite get all of the story. If there's more interesting things there about the negotiation with Squire, the decision not to go there. And I'm curious both of your thoughts more specifically on Erase Me's production, that you've, if you felt it was right or what was good and bad there.
Yeah. So legit right off rip, I remember the first time you showed me All My Teeth, Tim, we were at State Theater doing pre-pro in St. Pete, and you played it for me on the AirPods. And I just looked at you. I was like, are you guys okay? I was like, this is insane. I was like, I don't even know what this is. Let's get to shine. One pie without you. I'm not your fucking pride. So save yourself and no one else. What you believe? I'd never heard anything that scary from you guys, because like that's not like defined in a way. Like I had never heard y'all do shit like that. So it was like, oh. And I
like what? What was it? What do you mean scary? Stuff like what?
Just how chaotic and how dark it was. Like it was. It was like they literally were like upset, like there was something not okay, and like there is a problem. But it was also like it was music, so I was like, "Oh, you got like this is fucking sick!" Like I love angry shit, like I love it. But I was like, I've never heard you guys do this before. You guys are on some other shit right now, like, and I like this because it's like it's almost the Thrice thing. Like, look at the Alchemy Index; all four of those are so fucking different. And I was like, this is Under Oath doing that in a way. Like, this is Under Oath just saying, this is how we feel now. And obviously, I mean, that time I wasn't privy to a lot of the inner workings. Like, I was still pretty, I was really cutting my teeth in the crew then. And I was kind of shielding. I didn't want to get into the weeds with all that personal bullshit. That wasn't my place at that time. Like, I had still so much to prove on my own side of things that I wasn't caring about any of that shit. So I kind of really just stayed out of it and really just observed. And I mean, dude, it was interesting to see the fanatics' responses. Cause obviously, I mean, there's songs on there that Under Oath never would do again, like Wake Me or whatever. Like that is, those are not to me as a fan. I was like, that is not an Under Oath song. Like some of these are just not Under Oath songs. They just aren't. These are pop songs that Under Oath did. It's like somebody sold the song and Under Oath cut it like a country record. And it's like, is that wrong? No, like I'm not saying, it's just like an observation as like a diehard fan. It's like, well, that's interesting. I mean, everybody's allowed to do that. You know, every of my favorite bands have those songs on some of their records where I'm like, that just doesn't seem like you guys. Like, I don't know what that is. I don't hate it, but it's like, okay, well, that's interesting. I thought also what was interesting was just seeing like the fans have to figure that out. And that opened my eyes as somebody on the inner side, inner circle of like just perspective. And it made me realize like people are going to want what they want. And when they don't get it, they're going to bitch about it. And the same if they get it, like they're going to be stoked when they get what they want. And they're going to be so bummed at the band when they don't get what they want. And that's just what it is. I think that's all creativity. Like a band is putting themselves out there and people like it and they don't like it. And in another way, like for the band, there's songs on Voyeurist that don't exist without Erase Me. The sensibility, like the progression there, there are really great moments on it that you have to have. Like it's a part of a band's journey. Like you were saying earlier, Tim, like you don't know what's affecting you until like maybe 5 days later or shit like that. You know, it's like, this is just part of the process. And a band happens to just have that documented. Like regular people in regular lives don't publicly share their process, like share the struggle, like most people do that in private. Like that's in private lives. Bands just put it out to the world and everybody's like, that's trash or that's fucking amazing. It's like, it doesn't matter. It is what it is. Like, this is what you want to make of it. Now we gave our experience to you, and you could decide what you want to feel about that. And it's not about if you agree or disagree. It's just, do you, it's like liking a movie or not liking a movie.
Under Oath as a whole has always been its thing, and everyone else has to get on board. And we're going to push you left, we're going to push you right. Someone's going to say, what about a radio thing? We're going to go a little bit, maybe even too far at times, the opposite way, just to prove a point. And then with Erase Me being Aaron's first record back, we haven't done anything in a couple years because we've been broken up. It's like, what do we all really care about? And the answer was nobody understood what they cared about. Nobody knew. It's like, the only reason we're even interested in being a band again is because people care about our band. And people have made it known that they would love to see us more than this 5 or 6 week reunion tour. So let's honor that. And then when it came down to like creativity, it's like, well, where do we go from here? And nobody had an answer. And we had all of these new opportunities. We were out of our agreement. We could sign to a new label, get a new producer, try this, like radio's something that we've never done. And it was just an open field to me. And for me, I think the biggest thing is like, it's really hard to have a stance on something when you've never tried it. Like, it's easy to make fun of anyone, like a vegan or someone who's straight edge, if you've never tried it. And you're like, oh, they're so sad. It's like, why? You know, and our entire DNA was like, radio's stupid. This is dumb. This is sellout bullshit. We had this whole narrative that we baked into everything we've done without experience. And then when we kind of got back together in a different headspace creatively, it's like, well, what do we want to do? And the only thing we could answer, because we didn't know what we wanted, was nothing's off the table. If we want to try radio, if we want to try a new producer, if we want to try a new strategy, like, let's just do our best to have fun and stay amicable and enjoy what we're doing. And that's what Erase Me was to me, was a social experiment of, let's not change one thing because we don't change anything. Let's change all of it. And then in retrospect, kind of deep dive and do a post-op and figure out what worked and what didn't. And I think Erase Me overall was a success, quote unquote, but creatively, I think at least, if not almost all of the band views that record as a creative miss that needed to happen because of the circumstances.
Like a reset.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, I don't know.
And so that's a stepping stone. So that gave you the confidence that you know, the confidence then came that you did know what you wanted and that you could do it without Wisner, Squire, Goldman, etc. Adam D.
I don't think that Erase Me informed us knowing what we wanted. I think Erase Me to me was a giant back signal of like letting all of us know that none of us knew what we wanted. And to me, the only way to understand what we want is to get into a room with no one else, with no ties to a label or a radio department or a management team. And we just need to get into a room and figure out what we want to be now. I think a lot of the first demoing and writing sessions we had for what would become Voyeurist were us just trying to figure it out. And something magical happened where things just started like locking in and things just kind of like fell into place. And it's like, oh, this is what we've always been. And we haven't had this in 10 years. You know, Aaron was gone, came back, Erase Me was a whole whirlwind. It's like, dude, you quit in 2009. It's now 2020, 2021. Like we had a decade of figuring it out and now we're just now getting back to zero, you know? And it's like, we're finally mastering the record intellectually in our brains where it's hitting zero. And it's like, it is loud. It is what we want. All of the information is on the session. And now we're just at a brick wall. And it's like, oh, that's us. Here we go again.
Well, speaking of demos, we have the demo of Damn Excuses, which is really on point. But what preceded that demo? Do you remember Damn Excuses arising? Was that part of what was clicking, you know?
Yeah. We wanted to write a song heavier than Breathing Into New Mentality. We were like, let's beat it. Let's murder that thing right now. And let's, that can no longer be the heaviest one. We still love that song, but like, let's beat that thing. Tim and Rod got in there and just literally wrote that song in like 10 minutes, probably. Like, and it was done. Like the arrangement and like the gist was like there, you know, just like just full fledged chaos, heavy. Aaron had, what do you have, Tim? How did he had like a, he had like the build or whatever. And it was like a straight up pop song with like, I don't even know. I don't even remember.
Yeah. Aaron sent me a song for the record, possibly, that kind of started with just like, it was just this like pulsing, like da 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 da. And then it went into this big chorus and it was like a pop thing. And he was just like, I don't know if this even makes sense for an oath, but here's a song. I don't know where to put it. We could maybe make it heavier. And when we were writing it, I remember Aaron rolled in at 11 a.m. probably, because he's never late. He's always mad that everyone's pissed off. And or late. So he rolls in at 11 and he's like, dudes, we have all these songs. We have this song written. He's like, I just want to write a heater today. I remember that being the start of it. He goes, I want to write a heater today. And we were like, let's go.
Just mad. Just like, oh God.
And we went in, he was trying to do all these drum beats. Like, what if we started like this? And then, you know, we brought up the idea of the demo he sent previous, which was a pop song. It's like, that pulsing thing, which, you know, in retrospect feels a lot like On My Teeth, just the da 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 da, just that pulse. But it's like there's something there that actually makes sense, and it's like, what if we just took that and ran with it? And then we just got in the room and Aaron started playing drums and he was pissed that he had to do his kick drum
that long so fast. He was mad.
And it was just da 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 da, and he's just going, and then he knew when to stop. And I just remember going, oh, this is where the drop happens. Like very, almost EDM, like natural, of like, when you're doing songs like Damn Excuses specifically, to me, it's almost like a caveman song. It's not super intellectual. It's not this like, we're geniuses. It's like, go build. And then when you feel like you've built enough and you're tired, like, give me a payoff. And how do we make that payoff go? And then how do we make that payoff go when the payoff starts literally 20 seconds into the song? Where do we go from here? And so it, and that's where the creative process starts. It's like, okay, so we start here. You're already like, whoa, let's go. We're in a pocket. And now we have 2.5 more minutes
to figure out how to do this.
Yeah.
Now what? We just like gave it all away.
I think overall, yeah, it's like the, like, don't blow your load right now. And it's like, yeah, but if you do this, that just means you have to get better later. And that's where like the creative process comes in, and like JJ and all of us kind of cooking it. It's like, we can't be boring, but we want to hit like off rip. And we didn't know that it was going to be song one. We didn't know if it was even going to make the record. And so when you're building a song in a demo state where there's no expectations, there's no pressure, it's like, let's let this song just yell and speak, and let's capture it and let's chase it. And so we chased it, and it was done in literally 1.5 days, I think, even with vocals. Like, you think the dude went back that night and made the vocals in their Airbnb, and Aaron, yo, be saying fuck a lot.
Yeah.
And I promise you that was not intentional. He was like on the coffee table listening to this shit in his headphones with an SM7 that he borrowed from our studio. And he's like, we just went and this dude was just wiling out and we were like, that's kind of untouchable.
Yeah.
And it all just happened naturally. And then we had the demo.
The "Yo, did you get that?" actually came from that session and we kept it in the original version.
That's what I was going to ask because it's in the demo. Is it you or who's saying
that? Spencer. They're in their Airbnb and they're just checking the shit. And Spencer just looked at him and was like, "Did you get that?" And we were like, "That's perfect." Because it was in that song. And we just like, we're just not going to cut that out. It's just cool. It's a classic Under Oath move. Honestly, that's classic.
Something from the demo. Then the feedback is there that you had to remake feedback that was happening naturally the first time and stuff like that.
That was an accident also too. I was doing some of the master bus.
The intro of the song is also from the demo. The entire Voyeurist record for Damn Excuses is the entire intro from SoundCloud from 2 years prior or a year and a half prior, as well as "Yo, did you get that?" Like, that's why there's no feedback when the actual song kicks in, because that's when we started.
Yeah. We literally forgot to re-record. We didn't even think about it. We didn't even decide to re-record it. We just kept it from there. We didn't even think about it. Which that filter thing even happened kind of on accident, like legit. We were just working on the song in general. And I did something to the two bus and I like soloed a certain frequency. And Aaron literally just is like, we always make fun of him. He goes, "That, what is that? That right there, what is that?" He loves, that's all he says all the time. And he was like, "That's the beginning of the song. That's the intro right there. And then make it open up." I'm like, oh my God.
It's awesome.
That's so sick. It was fully on act, like so many accidents that you just don't question in the moment and you just roll. Like, yeah, let's fucking go. Like, I hate this later. Who cares? Who cares?
I think that's where JJ comes in a lot to me, is like, I remember him making the intro for the SoundCloud demo to send to labels or something. And it was like, he was literally manually ramping this thing and writing all of his automation and it opened up, but then the feedback that we recorded wasn't routed to the two bus. So if you listen, like Matt, I'm sure you know, but like the entire band is literally in this underwater filter with a ramp, but then the feedback comes in just like off rip normal.
Yeah, it doesn't have the and filter on it.
We forgot to like bus it to the filter bus. And we're like, oh, it's just a demo. And then when we got back to like record it, it's like, JJ just goes, "But what's wrong with that? Like, do you remember that moment? Like, does it take away from a song if it's not all perfectly filtered?" And it's like, well, no, but like we have to just re-record it because that's what re-recording is. Like, that's a demo. And JJ just goes, "No, fuck that. Like, the intro is fine." And like, it's literally a filtered intro with two other guitar tracks that were not routed properly that just come in. Ooh! And then the song starts.
That's amazing.
Amateur hour, dude.
I don't think it's amateur hour. I think it's more Ross Robinson than you're going to give yourself credit for.
I'll take it.
I think it's realizing what that was in the moment and going, we can try to recreate it, but why? It doesn't take away from the song. If anything, it just is what it was. And we were stoked on what it was. So don't fix it if it ain't broke. And then we redid the bridge. We redid the outro. There were a lot of overhauls on that song once we got the one day, like, stream of consciousness demo
and the real drum takes too. Like, when we got the real goods that Aaron really wanted to do, like, that's when we really started wrenching on the small shit, like Tim's riff in the bridge, you know, like just getting the feedbacks right. You know, Spencer was insistent on these chugs not having the note in it, so we literally spent a while just on the front part of that song just getting it to where Tim's fingers would hit it the right way on the palm mute to where it wouldn't resonate the A, you know?
It seems like the vision and purpose of it all kind of was there and came together. So you're in the studio now, this stuff's coming up, and you guys are the leaders of this process a little bit. I know that Gillespie was enjoying being in the environment that you created. So you've you've decided to roll forward in this environment that is wherever Tim is, where you are right now?
We started doing stuff at our studio just because it was pragmatic. We were all here.
Church was shut down too at the time. Balls deep in the pandemic. There was no one there ever.
We literally wrote the record in a haunted church. It was like they didn't meet. Like Watermark was not in service for almost a year and a half, I think. And the whole time we were the only people here. So we would be here in the morning and it's fine. And then we'd be here at night and there's this giant church downstairs, the sanctuary. Terrifying. Like there's only three people here now because one guy left and another guy had to go jump on a call or whatever. And it's like, we literally occupied this giant church in this small room for like weeks. And then in turn months, we started the record and it's like, it was completely empty. It was like the leftovers, like the rapture happened. Everyone's gone. We just go upstairs, but we can go anywhere. And I think as far as like the friction goes, it was really disarming and really inviting when you're doing demos because there's nothing on the line. We're just here. We're at this cool spot. It's within reason, not cost prohibitive to be here. We have to buy some Airbnbs. It's Tim and JJ's spot. We're all good. We're creating, the juices are flowing. King State's right down the road. We go there, you know, for dinner and or post studio and get a couple bottles of wine and do our thing. And then we reset, we do it again. And like the vibe was there. And then it came time to do the record. And it's like, do we go back to LA? Do we go back to Atlanta? Do we go back to DC with Squire? Like, where do we go? And I'll never forget, Aaron calls me and he's like, yo, food. He called it Food Store Studios, which is the nickname for King State, our bar. And he's like, I don't want to record anywhere but the Food Store Studio. He's like, I want to be at the studio. I want to be on the roof of King State. I want to drink wine. I want to rip. And I do not want to leave. And I'm not fucking going anywhere. I will fly to Tampa. I will not fly anywhere else.
Literally insisting.
And I was like, bro, this is literally what I've been trying to do for our whole career. And Aaron calls me and says this. And I'm like, dude, I've been in. And I call Raj and say, Raj, thanks for the demos. Do you actually want to make a real record? And he's like, what? I'm like, Rod doesn't want to leave. And frankly, he's kind of the driver. Like if Aaron needs something, even if we don't need it and don't want it, we'll do it. And not say that he's a diva, but he's such a huge force that he has a pulse on where we're going creatively. And it's like where Rod goes, we all go.
Yeah, and we don't challenge him. We don't question him. We just let him lead us until the next time we need to figure it out. Like what's the next
thing? Need to stop. Yeah.
And then what, then Tim will take over or something. And we follow him for a little bit and vice versa. You know, all that just keeps evolving as you go.
It wasn't all the way bought in that this was going to work to continue down this demo in our church attic part. Like did the resistance ever show up in the process?
Chris was literally working a full-time IT job. So he couldn't be at any studio anywhere. Even when we did it in Tampa, he still wasn't here. He was on text, on Dropbox. He was fully engaged, but remote. And so when Aaron says, you, me, Raj, we're going to make the record. And I say, let's fucking go. Done. The next thing is, what do we do about Spencer? You know, and Spencer's been through a lot. And he's overcome so much. And he's, I think, currently in the best place he's ever been. But artistically and creatively, we still hadn't really figured out where Aaron starts and Spencer ends and vice versa. And I think there was a bit of trepidation of like, what do we do with the vocals? And I think that got really tough.
Well, and that's like, I feel like that took 2 weeks to get there too. Like we spent so much time on just the music.
A lot.
And it was like this thing in the back of all of our heads of like, we are not even close to done here. And like, we just, in my head, it was almost a little bit of existential dread of just like, this is going to be a fucking thing here in a second. Like, I'm so stoked we're getting all these songs sounding awesome and heavy and shit. But like, we haven't even started the hard part yet. Like, getting everyone feeling comfortable and like, in not even in a bad way of like, oh my God, we got to fucking deal with this. It was more just like, this is,
we don't yet work.
Yeah. We have to be, and I say, especially for me and Tim, we had to become a lot more hyper aware of how Spencer felt and how to get him feeling comfortable and really understanding that and not trying to understand it with him in a condescending way, like legitimately motivating him to be comfortable. Figuring that out, like almost like a psychiatrist, like making him comfortable so that he could do what he does best. And that just took very specific effort on me and Tim's part of just like how to communicate, what to communicate, how, just, you know, methods to just motivate and not just piss him off. And same with Aaron, like Aaron got a little butt hurt and just wouldn't help Spencer out. And he was just upset that he wasn't the one singing and we had to just shut the session down. And I looked at Aaron, I was like, he needs you to produce him. This is what self-producing is. This is not my gig right now. I can't tell him what to do. Like you do, like, you know, Tim can't tell him. We don't know. Like we're figuring it out. We know what we like, but like, I don't know how to get that out of him. I don't know how to get that out of Speed. A lot of learning processes for that. Like on my side, on Tim's side, probably like, really what makes Speed click, because I've never experienced Speed in that setting. So it was like new territory. So me and Tim had to switch and kind of like kick Aaron's ass into gear and be like, bro, you got to fill in this gap here. Like we have a deficiency slightly. We need you to help us. Like he needs you to help him and you need him to help you too. Like this is a fully self-service thing here we've got going on and you have to be on deck, ready to go. You cannot rely on me and Tim to just drive the whole car. Like you got to take a shift, bro.
Yeah, because vocals are that trusted thing that's the most taboo of all to speak into, or who doesn't speak into it, and you know, all of the juju goes into that. Like, what's the magic of that? There, you know, it's the most mystical and personal and expressive part. So it's the hardest part to gain the trust in both the sound technology and the process and the vulnerability of. And so, and Gillespie, you know, he,
that's his gig, that's what he's, yeah, good at. Like he's so,
but
good.
Also conflict, and like he will avoid and side text Randy instead of deal with a thing. So now, but now you guys need him because you don't have the credibility with Spencer that he does.
Yep. And like, and literally, Aaron, don't hit up Randy right now. Like we need to figure this out right now. Like the problem is in this room, not anyone else. Like that's it, let's go. Like we have to figure this out. If your kid does something bad, are you just going to let him be bad still? Like, no, you're his dad. You're going to figure it out. You're going to discipline him, make him change. We got to do the same thing here, buddy. Like, let's figure this out. Let's just talk about it. Like, let's get this done. And they had the most trust within themselves. It was almost like I didn't even want to be there mentally for them in that way. It was like, dude, just let me hit record. Let me do the nerd side. And y'all just drive, bro. Y'all do your thing. Like, that's all we need to do.
And that breakthrough came from the conflict of the night where you drank all the beer and had the White Claw and had one White Claw remaining.
The White Claw night was the culmination of all of us observing situations and then seeing a situation and observing it from different angles and all trying to figure out how to solve it. And to JJ's point, the one thing we weren't going to do is call in backup. We didn't need the label. We didn't need Randy. We didn't need someone to be like, how do we tell this person this? It's like, we're doing this. And the whole point of doing this is to grow and to build trust. And up until Voyeurist, I don't think that any member of Under Oath has ever been in the vocal booth or in the room while someone's in a vocal booth doing vocals at scale ever, like 6-7 albums, like nothing.
That's insanity.
It's like, give us 5 hours, come back, you can have comments, but we're going to work through it over here without anyone's input. And in my head, I'm like, what if the thing that you thought was cool initially that someone else overrode was actually the best part? And that was kind of the big ethos for specifically me and Chris moving forward. It's like, we understand Aaron and Spencer are doing a thing that is very personal. We understand that vocals and lyrics are specifically not the same as who wrote a riff. It's very easy to demean a vocalist and go, but you're like, well, who wrote the bass part? Who cares? Like, it's just vocals. It's not just vocals. Like, vocals are a very precious and specific thing, but there was a mentality of, if we're gonna do this, we have to figure out a way to disarm any discomfort, but also not allow things to constantly be happening without everyone being aware of what's happening. And that was the biggest pitfall and the biggest hurdle that we had making this record was, Aaron calls me, he has a vision for vocals. And I'm like, great.
What's B think?
Yep. And he's like, oh dude, it's gonna be a whole thing. And it's like, why is it going to be a whole thing? I'll handle it. No, you won't handle it. Like, we should all just handle it. And we went through all of the recording process for the demos, and then we started the record, and the entire record was going smoothly, but we all were looking at each other knowing, like, as soon
here it comes.
The last guitar part is done, the real work's going to start. And we haven't dealt with this. We all know we haven't. And I can see it on Spee's face and Aaron's face and my face and Chris's face and JJ's face. And we all knew something was going to have to be brought up. Was it going to be an explosion? Was it going to be a nudge? Was it going to be the manipulation of a producer?
Passive aggressive.
Oh, dude, like, you're so good, but like, I think like you're too good. So like all that bullshit. No.
Yeah, the ego stroking is the typical method of the, you know, the commercial producer. Basically,
and
yeah.
we've seen that, and I think the idea was, like, if I was Spencer and if I was Aaron, I would want to be treated like an adult, you know, and they've never been treated like adults. They've been treated like these people that do a thing that is mystical, and so Aaron will complain here and Spencer will complain here. And what's so funny is, like, resentment and perceptions build up over decades and 3, 4, 5 records. And the second you just say, we're not leaving, Raj, go down to Sly Petrol Mart and get all the gear they have, bring it all back, and we're going to fucking hash this out. And literally
5 hours later, literally
everyone in a half day of work, 4 or 5 hours, everyone understands, everyone said everything they've wanted to say for a decade, and we're done. And the fact that no producer, no manager, no band member, more importantly, none of us ever thought to just, like, lock ourselves in a room and talk about it.
Talk it out.
And it's like, the second you do, the next day, it's like, yo, what about Aaron here? And it's like, what about who? Yeah. You know, you guys are thinking about the song now. You're thinking about the project now. You're thinking about your strengths and the other person's strengths. And it's really hard to understand from our perspective, because it's like, I'm the guitar player. I play bass. Chris is the keyboard guy. There's not another guy who's equally good at Ableton and or Logic, but is just a different style. Like, our vocals are the only time when we have two people that are unbelievable at what they do, and every part and every section is almost like an audition. And it's like, you know, there's Matthew McConaughey and there's Tom Cruise, and you both serve purposes and you're both ballers, but sometimes this guy makes more sense than this guy. And it's not a degradation. It's merely, boys, what does the song need?
Yeah, and it's flavors, bro.
We broke through on that finally.
That's amazing. And so Spencer had buy-in, and you could tell once he did, like, you could, like, he had his moment where then you could tell he was a believer in the process you had now undertaken.
I thought it was really that once Aaron and Spee could trust each other, like, it's not like they don't, but like once they got the cats out of the bag, they could fully trust each other and be brutal with each other in constructive criticism way. Like the second that happened, like nobody's feelings got hurt anymore. Did they have disagreements still? Of course we did. We had arguments about what shit should be, but it was under the guise of like, everyone is doing this for the best reason. It's not about the other bullshit like it used to be anymore. Like it was literally like before we left that night, the White Claw night, we were literally like, we are not going to argue about this shit anymore. Like we've just squashed it. We are done. We don't go back. Like we are going to move forward and we're going to get these vocals done. And if there's dog shit that comes up, we're going to take care of it and we're going to take the trash out. And then we're going to move on from that also. You know what I mean? Like that's, and it's just as simple as that. We were like, guys, let's just stop being dumb about this and let's just be straight up and fuck your feelings, bro. Just get it out there. Like, honestly, because we got a record to make. This is more important than any of us. So let's just do that. We've already squashed it. Everybody knows. Let's just roll, boys. Everything's fine. Let's go.
So now that you're in this place and everything else, on the song Damn Excuses, as producers, looking at it from this view now, it's out. Everybody's heard it. It's, you know, not only the single, but the whole album's out. What is special about the album version of Damn Excuses?
The chaos and just, we didn't wait any second. The first time I heard it, I kept looking at everybody. I'm like, this is the Under Oath 3 Kids Later. It's like, they think we're soft. Fuck you. Listen to this shit. You think you're washed up. You think you're too old. You think you need to stop at the scene. We said, fuck all of that. And here's what we want to say to you now. It's like right out of the gate. We're not wasting any time. We're going to get right to it. Pulling the Band-Aid off and let's go. To me, that's the most special.
I think the philosophy on what opens a record is the same as like, how do you create a song or a record? There's so much influence over decades that play into that. But for me, I still go back to like being a consumer and not having these rollouts and these singles that drop on DSPs and all that. It's like, I want to eradicate any notion that Under Oath isn't back, like in my head. And Erase Me, again, wasn't this big departure. It wasn't this like act of defiance or we crippled ourselves. But we all knew that Erase Me wasn't who we are and we didn't know what we were at the time. And for me, it's like, that song goes first. We're going to send nukes off rip. You're going to get your grass mode. And then you're going to be bought in for the rest of the ride. And if you want to hear Wake Me, or if you want to hear Reinventing Your Exit, like go back and listen to those songs. They've already been done. You're on a new ride. And it's like, we're going to kick it off rip. And it's like, there's no other way to do it. And that's also very congruent with all of our records. It's like you have In Regards, you have Breathing in a New Mentality. You have all of these songs, On My Teeth even, which I think is one of the best songs on Erase Me. It's like you put your best foot forward, and then our job as an artist and a creative team is to make sure that in 7 songs, there's something equally, if not better, than the song you started with. And everyone always front loads records, and we weren't trying to front load it. I wanted to just come out with a statement. 2.5 minutes. It's under 3 minutes. You're going to get your ass beat to death.
Yeah. And then everybody wants.
We're going to go on a journey. And we're going to go on a journey. And if you're not here for the journey, like cancel it, like delete it. But like there's Thorn, there's Cycle, there's Pneumonia. There's so much depth. But if you can't literally stomach 2.5 minutes of punishment, like I don't want you listening to my record. Frankly.
Please stop listening.
Literally. PSA. Like you know what you're getting into. And I feel like to me, there was like there was I vividly remember on the Erase Me cycle when we released On My Teeth as like the first single. And I saw a bunch of comments that are etched in my brain. This song rips. It's pretty good. It's really good. It reminds me of this. It's not as good as that. Wherever everyone was at, the only request at the end of every comment was, I hope this is just the start, not the end. And I remember thinking through that as someone who follows us, someone who likes our band, going, no, this is like actually one of the coolest songs on the album. And there's maybe two or three other ones that even hold a candle to On My Teeth. And they were like, that's a good baseline. I pray that it goes up from here. And in reality, like Damn Excuses is a good baseline and it does go up from here. And it's better than On My Teeth. It's better than a lot of these songs to me. And it's a, when you can come out and deliver an impactful 2.5-3 minute heater off rip and not give away all of what the record has in the first song, you're doing something good. And to me, it's like, you're going to hear the song, you're going to be pumped, you're going to send it to your friends. Oh, I'm going to headbang. We're going to get all the videos on social media. I don't give a shit about any of that. Just know that this is just the start of the ride, not the end. Where before, On My Teeth was kind of the start and the end of the ride. And you had to push through a lot to get to the next thing that made you feel like the first thing. Where this record, to me, was like, it just gets better. It keeps going. It's programmed always. You know, I want the last song to make you cry more than the first song made you headbang.
Funny that it's like the same too. Like the last song is a headbang and horribly sad all at the same time. It's like the complete polar opposite of the beginning of the record.
And you know, being that this is a Damn Excuses episode, like the way we start the record with Damn Excuses also informed the way we ended the record with Pneumonia. Like Pneumonia and Damn Excuses end the same way. It's just it's the same thing. And no one will ever pick it up. And if they do, they won't understand that it's intentional. But we literally intended to start and end the record
with the breakdown.
With for as long as we could. And it's so cool to listen to it. And if you listen to it on repeat, it's a different tempo. It's a different key, but you start and end where you started. And we wanted to draw a full loop because Erase Me was not a full loop. Erase Me was, it was a mall. It was like there's a Gap and there's a Foot Locker and we love all of these places equally, but correct, you know? And Erase Me was not a cohesive body of work. It was merely a really good collection of good songs. And with this, it's like, we need to go back and also learn from everything we've learned so that we don't repeat ourselves. But the ethos stayed the same and everything else was just everything updated. We updated all the iOSs. We updated all the firmware. We gather our experience and it's like, let's start it and end it in the same way and make sure that everyone goes, why wasn't that longer? Which my brother-in-law said that. He said, why is your record so short? Like, bro, it's 37 minutes. It just felt short. I listened to it at the gym and I got through the entire record before my workout was done. And I felt like it was over like that. I'm like, good. That's the point.
Yeah. In and out.
You're on a ride, you lose time, you have fun, you get sad, you come down, you go up, and then you end right where you started. And now you just want to start it over.
Yeah. Because you're like, well, now what? I don't feel good anymore.
I love that.
That's really, really well put. Now, I'm in love with the Digital Ghost version of Damn Excuses. So that's a whole nother topic, but it certainly belongs here on that song because now we have the demo version, the album version, and the Digital Ghost version, which is cool.
Lost.
Digital Ghost one is honestly as no holds bar as it gets, because it is the actual, it is all six, five. I mean, Chris wasn't able to be there, but it was literally the five dudes in one room playing live. Like, literally. James and Grant were there, crushing, doing their thing. We did two takes of each song in one day, and it was done. So that's Damn Excuses is literally just the boys going and doing what they would do if they opened, like they did at Furnace Fest. It literally is as no holds bar, no brass tacks, like straight up UO as it gets. Like, this is what these dudes are. This is what they do. Like, and it's, to me, it really is so different than the record version. Like, it feels different. The way that Grant plays bass versus the way that Tim plays bass, even though it's the same notes, it literally feels completely different. It is entirely different. And it's cool different, though. Like, I love it. It creates depth to me. It's like, oh, we can show a lot of sides of ourselves very easily, you know? And I think it's cool, you know?
I'm a huge fan, and I can't help but prefer the Digital Ghost version as its reality. I mean, I prefer it as an Under Oath experience because the visuals there, and because I know how live it is. Like, something about it even transcends that. I mean, the album version is what would belong on Spotify, but the Digital Ghost version is so alive and real that I just love it. It's my favorite of all the versions.
And the best part is we demoed, and then we spent a ton of time dialing every single piece of arrangement and melody. And then we went in and in 3 days again, and JJ mixed it. And we didn't have, you know, all the time and all the budget. And what's interesting, going back to the Ross Robinson tie-in, is like, what if Digital Ghost was just our actual album? Would anyone care? Would anyone think that it's better or worse? I don't know. But that, I think, is where we're going collectively, is like, who cares if it was done in a bedroom or a garage or a church or a $2 million studio? Like, does it make me feel? Does it move me?
Yeah, I mixed it in this room that I'm sitting on these headphones. Like, nothing, no frills, nothing. Simple.
Yeah, like you're literally looking at where Digital Ghost is mixed right now.
Is it?
You know, and it's just that weird thing of, if there's a passion and there's a DNA and you can capture it, everything else doesn't matter. And I think we're going more insular than more external. Like, in my head, I'm like, I'd like to record a record not in 50 days. What if the first vocal part that we had, because we don't have time, was actually better than what you hear on the record? Like, I'm psychologically, I think that creative people that are good at what they do have the best idea off rip. And the longer you spend, the longer you neuter and castrate, not make it better.
You're not reacting anymore.
Yeah. Like, we have to react, and we have to understand when reacting is different than distilling.
Correct. And you get distillation trying to make it better. Intentions are great, but you're fucking it up. Like, just stop. You were right to begin with. Like,
well, that is a perfect place to wrap here, because I was just texting with Gillespie, and I know for sure that is his mindset, and that he is so allergic to technical things and redoing and continuing to do things. He's the most of anybody I know who has that, and I'm curious, and I want to do the next episode. It'll be him and JJ is the plan, I think, as of now, but that's exactly what we're going to jump into. But why is he so allergic to technical work?
He hates thinking. He literally says that to me all the time. With drums, he's like, stop fucking thinking. If you're thinking, you're fucking it up. Stop thinking. Don't spend extra time thinking about it, because you're going to overanalyze and you're going to get yourself into a hole. And is that 100% correct all the time? I don't think so personally, but sure is a damn good place to start. You know, it's a lot that comes from that. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, you know?
Yeah. I think Aaron, to me, is the epitome of Big Bang and evolution can figure itself out on the other end. Like I'm here to burst new life into the atmosphere. And I don't care if something that has three legs gets four legs. I'm not here for the time. Like, he doesn't care.
He said, don't talk to me about mixing. I don't want to hear the mastering. I just want to explode now and that's it.
I'll say this. I got a call from Aaron and a text multiple times once we got done with the demos in 2020. When we got done with the demos, we had a SoundCloud. We're like, oh, let's listen to this. There's like edits that aren't right. There's stuff that was like plugged in later with overdubs. The mix is all wild. He goes, why don't we just release this? The record's done. I don't even want to come back and do it again. And then when he realized he couldn't just release the SoundCloud in a week, he goes, I don't want to go anywhere else but where I'm comfortable. And I don't think Aaron's allergic to work or technical prowess. I think what Aaron's in contrast, Aaron's attracted to environments. And he's like, if you put me in a sterile environment where we're talking about, did I accidentally hit a fucking mic when I did the fill and now we have to redo it because the tom's never going to sound the same, you can fuck off and jump off a cliff.
He'd say, who am I not paying? Get that shit out of my way.
Like Aaron's whole thing is, I'm playing drums, whatever I played, if I feel good on it, it's someone else's job to make it sound good. And even if it doesn't sound good, that's the one that I want to be on a record because I believe in that take. And he's so artistic, which I think is why we've always connected personally, regardless of personal shit. Like from an artist level, Aaron and I have a through line where we look at each other and it's like, this is what we're doing. He called me and said, we're not doing it at your studio and we're not doing it with anyone but Raj. And I said, I've been waiting for this call. And he's like, cool, just wanted to let you know. And I said, awesome. And it was done. And everyone just fell in line. It's just like, Aaron is so about an environment. He's like, I want to be somewhere shitty. I want to be somewhere that's not cool. And he's done the most cool stuff of any of us. He's played Madison Square Garden. He's played late night shows with Paramore. He's done all of it. And he's like, none of it matters. This band, my shit, stays dirty, it stays raw, and we're just not going to do it more than we have to. All the way down to suggesting that we release a SoundCloud, which we have to get, you know? But he literally, if nobody pushed back, we would have a record out a year and a half ago, and it would be a SoundCloud leak. He's like, I don't care. And I love that.
That's amazing. You guys are the best. I'm so glad you pushed through and developed this process and did it this way. Looking forward to talking to him more about it and then Spencer after that and the rest of these songs. I think I'm so glad the album is out now and people are reacting to it. It totally hits different. I've been listening to it since you first finished it, but it totally hits different now that it's out there in the ether and it's on. I can listen to it in Spotify and its environment. That's a digital environment, but it's a real one. And the perspective I have on it now, I continue to appreciate it. And you know, it's like when other people hear things, you hear it different yourself now.
Yeah.
And so I've been hearing about this music and connected you guys for a long time. And I am in a mode where I feel, man, we're celebrating now because this thing's out and people are getting it. So yeah. Great work. I'm so glad you guys are the producer team and that you got it the way that you got it. And I look forward to how this will continue to evolve from here now that you got the, you know, everybody's syncing up and I don't know, it's good stuff. So I'm very, very stoked on it and I appreciate the opportunity to explore it so deeply.
Hell yeah.
Cool.
All right. Cheers, y'all.
Sick.
Thank you guys.
Absolutely. See ya.
See ya.